Thank you all for coming tonight. It's my pleasure to welcome you to the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture on behalf of Mr. Howard Dodson, who unfortunately could not be with us tonight. And he was very sorry because he knows he's missing a great, great, great program. But I'm so excited to have this two-day forum in tribute to Michael Jackson. If I say that I am a fan, I think I won't be alone. And if I say that I grew up listening to his music and that his music marked probably all stages of my life, from little girl to teenager to college student to grown woman, I would not be alone either. So I think that unfortunately, I don't have a special Michael Jackson story to tell you. And I know that our panelists, our moderators, our guests tonight will probably do much better than me. What I want to say is that I was very fortunate to have DJ Lene Denise to come to me with this wonderful idea for this forum. And we're so excited to present it in collaboration with her here at the Schomburg Center. This event also would not be possible without the help of a great intern that I had the pleasure to work with, Ashley Bowden. And without her, frankly, I don't think we would have pulled it off. So I want to welcome you again to the Schomburg Center. If it's your first time, please come again. Come tomorrow. We have wonderful panels. Come for our exhibitions. Come for our wonderful programming coming up this month, but also for the new season. I know you sign up for our email list, so you'll hear from us. So now, help me welcome DJ Lene Denise. Thank you.
Greetings. First of all, I can't even imagine what it would have felt like in my life to be on stage from ages 6 through 50. Like Michael Jackson, ages 6 years old through 50, because I'm 35 and I struggled to think about what the heck I was gonna say, and his life was on the world stage. So can we just applaud his life, just for the record? Thank you. So I would like to thank the Schomburg for agreeing to host this conversation, this forum, but very specifically Clarice, who from day one was open to the idea of hosting an event and saw this as an opportunity to provide the space for a much needed dialogue about someone who I believe was one of, if not the, most popular human being in the world. Will we say that? Could we say that one of the most popular? So to be hosting that discussion at one of the most important cultural institutions in America, I think, is just
in the world.
So I'm honored. But also, yes, I wanted to echo the love for Ashley Bolin, who is a Schomburg intern. I don't know if people understand the value of an intern. Like, interns are valuable, and Ashley Bolin, with her skills, actually introduced us to the importance of Google Documents, okay, and coordinating this event and making sure that everyone stayed informed. And so thank you, and if we could just give a round of applause to the intern, Ashley Bolin. And I also want to say a special thank you to Idrissa Simmons, who is the language architect for Wild Seed Cultural Group. How many of you were at least attracted to, interested in the language around the event, the actual language? Was it something that was at all interesting? We were hoping to be clear about our intention and make it known that this is a safe space for a discussion about Michael. So many discussions about Michael have been unsafe, unhealthy, and traumatizing, quite honestly. So this is not a space where you will hear the term Jacko. This is a... You will not hear Wacko Jacko in this space. You may get jumped if you say that after the bill. This is not a Wacko Jackal space. So, hello. No, people will get jumped if you say Wacko Jackal. But so, right. And that's the last time I'm going to say it? Okay. So, but welcome again to After the Dance. After Michael died, my three nieces, ages 4 through 8, watched Michael Jackson video marathons for about 3 days straight. 3 days straight, ages 4 through 8. And so for me, that was huge. That spoke to just how much of an impact, you know, he had in the world, but certainly in their lives. And of course, they knew Beat It, they knew Billie Jean, but it was Smooth Criminal that was, I guess, what is that the case for Chosen? Smooth Criminal? It was Smooth Criminal that caught their attention. That, what is it?
They don't really care about that.
That as well, exactly. But Smooth Criminal for them, I mean, to be honest, I really felt like we watched it about 37 times after he died. I was like, I know that we've watched it at least 30 times. And so I wanted to make things interesting, and so I offered them $100 if they could count the total number of times that they heard in Smooth Criminal, right? How many of you have ever tried to chase Michael? Michael's hee-hees. How many of you tried to chase them? Chase them, like, what? Right? Right on the song. And so my oldest niece struggled, especially when she got to 15 us and realized that she had missed about 5 us, right? And plus there was 3 minutes left in the song, right? And so she was like, okay, I'm actually like, I can't follow his us, you know? So it was in that moment that she realized as an 8-year-old how truly talented and ridiculously gifted this man was and how he used his body as an instrument, both literally and metaphorically. So he literally used his body to dance, to pop lock, to moonwalk, to tap dance, to beatbox, to spin, to direct, to sing, to tour, to compose, to create, to produce. But he also used his body to communicate a possible preference for a smaller nose and, many believe, lighter skin. And because of what his death brings up for us, I thought it makes sense. I thought it made sense to have a loving and informed response to the call that came up when he died. There was a call that demands a response. And so I hope that After the Dance provides a space for us to have those conversations that we've had for the last 10 years privately about Michael Jackson and what was going on with him and what was great about him. Not all of the panelists claim to be Michael Jackson aficionados. But there's enough knowledge of his work and love for what he shared to create, like I said, a safe space for us to honor the difficulties that surrounded his life, right, and his musical career. So there's a book actually called The Same River Twice, Honoring the Difficult, from Alice Walker. Actually, Alice Walker wrote it, and it's an interesting statement to honor the difficult. And that's what comes up for me when I think about Michael Jackson and his entire life. We can absolutely, you know, learn from his magic, but I think it's also important to honor the difficult. And so before I continue, Eternal, I would like to actually let Michael open as well and say a few words through one of the most important videos in the human experience, and that is Thriller. And so if we could just take a moment, 13 minutes of a moment to, first of all, 13 minutes of you know, to acknowledge this. Yeah, Thriller.
Honestly, we're out of gas.
So, what are we gonna do now? I'm sorry I didn't believe you.
Can I ask you something?
What?
You know I like you, don't you?
Yes.
And I hope you like me the way I like you.
Yes.
I was wondering if you would be my girl.
Oh, Michael. It's beautiful.
Now it's official. I have something I want to tell you.
Yes, Michael.
I'm not like other guys.
Of course not. That's why I love you.
No, I mean I'm different.
What are you talking about? Are you all right?
Get away!
All through the night. across the land. The midnight hour is close at hand. Creatures crawl in search of blood to terrorize your neighborhood. And whosoever shall be found without the soul for getting down must stand and face the hounds of hell and rot inside a corpse's shell. Stenches in the air, the funk of 40,000 years, and grisly ghouls from every tomb are closing in to seal your doom. And though you fight to stay alive, your body starts to shiver, for no mere mortal can resist the evil of the thriller.
Come on, I'll take you home.
For three people: Rod Temperton, who wrote Thriller, Quincy Jones, but also Michael Peters, who choreographed both Thriller and Beat It. And actually, so I just want to, those are the people who are behind the team of the Michael Machine as well, and so just wanted to say thank you to them as well. John Landis, and whoever else that we know, there's a machine behind Michael and that was directed by him, however, and so thank you to those people. So I would like to take a moment to, first of all, we know that both Nelson George and Torre are here. Round of applause for them. And thank them for agreeing to set the tone for the conference. I'm excited that Nelson George, who just released his book, Thriller, The Musical Legacy, The Musical Life of Michael Jackson, which actually is available at the Schomburg. Also, Nelson George is one of the first Black authors to write the Michael Jackson story, and was it 84? In 84, and that's huge. Like, Michael Jackson told through the lens of a Black person who experienced him in America, that's important. And so thank you for that, and congratulations on the new book. But both Nelson George and Torre are walking cultural institutions. They're walking cultural institutions. The amount of information and the encyclopedic knowledge of culture and music and politics that they both share is reflected in the body of work that they've developed over the past few decades. And so thank you very much, and please welcome Nelson George and Torre to the stage.
Hello, everyone. How are you? Yeah. This time last night, it was at the Hammerstein Ballroom, surrounded by Southern rappers. I work on a show called Hip Hop Honors, and so we recognize the Dirty South. And seemingly, that's about as far from Michael Jackson as you could possibly get. But for me, Michael, hip hop, all of these things are intertwined. One of the things about Michael Jackson's career that's important to recognize is that his own accomplishments allowed many, many, many scores, hundreds, maybe thousands of people to have careers, and I'm one of them. Not to say I wasn't writing before, but his ascendance gave me a career I probably wouldn't have had before, so it's interesting. And so when I think about the fact that here I am, I'm a middle-aged Black man, I've written two books about Michael Jackson. Who would have thought, A, that you're a Black author, you write to get two books about anybody. and then books about the same person in a lifetime. So it's kind of weird for me to be here 25 some odd years later thinking about this guy's life. And, you know, another Virgo, for that matter, which is also, we were like born a year apart. It's very weird. So I want to talk a little bit about the context of my meeting my embrace of the Michael Wuerl and my career and how these things are intertwined, at least for me, and how they kind of interplay with chronicling Black culture. Coming up, I started my career at the Amsterdam News, a few blocks away, down there. And from the time I started as a college student at St. John's University up until through 84 into 85, there were only three things that were really interesting to write about. I mean, there were things I wrote about because they were good records, but things were really interesting culturally to write about, and that was hip-hop, which was happening here in the streets of Harlem and the Bronx and other parts of the city. There was Prince, who was coming out of Minneapolis, and there was Michael Jackson. Those were the three things that were coming up and beginning to rearrange the molecules in the air in terms of Black music and Black culture. Hip-hop I knew because I was around these streets and I saw DJ Hollywood and Kool Herc and all of that going on. Prince I actually had a very strangely intimate relationship with, at least in the beginning. I interviewed him when he first came to New York in 81. When he played, in fact, I saw him play The Bottom Line, which is a club that no longer exists, a great venue downtown. And then that was before Dirty Mind came out. And then I interviewed him with Dirty Mind, and I was like, whoa, because that record was such a breakthrough sexually, lyrically, musically. And so I got to know him a bit. Michael's the one I knew the least in terms of personally, but I had a lot of incredible amount of contact with the world of Michael, which was Joe, his mother, Quincy, a lot of the musicians who played on all those records. Because at that point in time, Los Angeles was the center of all things going on with Black music. From the time Motown moved to L.A. and all in the early 70s, every significant Black company at that time was out of Los Angeles. I'm talking about Solar Records, The Whispers. I'm talking about Barry White. I'm talking about the Gap Band, which was on Total Experience Records. Everything was going on in L.A., and I was a New York City boy, and I would go out to Los Angeles to this world that was a world that was Michael Jackson's world. The Motown building, which is on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood, was the nexus of everything. Motown was in this building on Sunset Boulevard. Joe Jackson's management company was in the same building. So you could go down a second floor and you'd see Joe. You might see Janet. You might see LaToya. Randy's running around as a little kid. So there's this whole world that Michael was part of. It was also, there's a guy who comes up, it's interesting. He doesn't come up a lot in the narrative, but people were very surprised. When Michael Jackson passed, one of the people who became in charge of his estate was a guy named John McClain. Now, John McClain is one of the mystery people of Black music. Because John I knew him very well when I first went out there. He sort of embraced me and sort of took me around Black Hollywood LA at that time. And he was good friends, best friends with Jermaine. He grew up with Michael. He was part of their kind of Encino mafia, which they had, there was a whole Black Hollywood world of young people who come up. Some of them were Motown kids. Some of them were kids of, like, Quincy Jones's kids. There was a whole world that he was part of. I mean, it was the first time as a New Yorker I'd seen Black wealth. I mean, you had doctors and you went to Sag Harbor, but there was Hollywood Black wealth, and this was going on, and the Jacksons were part of that, that kind of Black royalty that was developing. So John took me around, and John's the one who signed Janet Jackson and put Janet with Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. So he's a key guy. John would then become more mysterious as time went on. It's a long story, but he's almost his own book himself. But essentially, later on, he went on to work at Interscope Records and was the man who actually helped put together the deal that brought Dr. Dre and Suge Knight to Interscope and that thing. And so he's been involved in so much stuff. He owns Marvin Gaye's studio in L.A. He owns it. Where Marvin made all those incredible records. And at the end of the day, he became the person that Michael trusted, one of the two people, to have his estate. So there's all these interconnections out there that go back to childhood that are still at play, even in Michael's legacy to this day. Let's talk a little bit about Quincy. So I met Quincy during the time of the Dude album. And people forget the Dude album. The Dude was a platinum, won the Grammys Album of the Year. it was Quincy was himself, you know, a major producer, even you know, as his own entity. And on that album, he introduced James Ingram, Patty Austin, and his whole world. So this is all before Thriller. This is after Off the Wall, but before Thriller. So Quincy's his own man. And I remember interviewing Quincy sometime in 82. He was working on almost Donna Summer. And he was just starting work on this album that didn't have a name yet that Michael was doing, the follow-up to Off the Wall. And it was interesting because he was, as a Michael Jackson person, he was already threatened by Prince. And there was a whole lot of discussion about, I mean, it's interesting, this whole dynamic that Prince-Michael Jackson was this dialogue that went on for the whole decade of the 80s. You know, who was better, who was more dynamic, who was this or that. You know, and so it's interesting also, of all the people who've spoken about Michael's passing, Prince has been one who hasn't, actually. I don't know if anybody's seen, I've never seen Word One. It's very interesting because of that connection, that symbiotic rivalry that emerged between the two of them. So how this book, the first book came together, comes out of this whole world. There was a big article about Michael Jackson that came out in Rolling Stone by Jerry Hershey. It was a massive piece. It was the first real profiles of the adult Michael Jackson. And a publisher called Dellett approached her about writing a Michael Jackson book, and she turned it down. I was either second or third choice. I had been working, I was at Billboard magazine, and this chance to get $7,000, which was a whole lot of money in 1983, to write this book about Michael Jackson. Michael himself was very hard to get a hold of. I actually had one conversation with Michael, and it's pretty classic Joe Jackson how I had this conversation. I went to Joe's office. I was working on a piece for Billboard magazine. And Joe, this is during a time, as those who know Michael's history, there was a lot of struggle about who was going to control Michael. You know, he had a couple of white managers who were actually very competent guys. Joe was involved. It was a very, very touchy situation. And so I was sitting there in the office, and Joe, I guess he decides he wants to prove to me that he can make Michael do what he wants to do. He calls on the phone and says, talk to him. And it was a very awkward scenario, to say the least, because, like, it's Joe bullying Michael again, you know. And I'm trying to, you know, ingratiate myself, and obviously this is the wrong context to become friends with Michael Jackson. And then that office itself, it was a weird place because Joe was, you know, Joe's good and bad. I'm actually somewhat of a semi-fan of Joe Jackson, which comes up as one of the things I talk about in the book. And I say that about Joe. I think Joe's, in a way, the key person in this whole narrative about Michael. Let's think about this. It's Gary, Indiana. It's the 1950s. You work in a steel mill. You got, like, how many kids?
Nine
kids. And a house that's about the biggest size of this stage. Maybe not that big. He discovers one day that, you know, one of his sons, Tito, can play his guitar. He discovers that other kids have been working together and decides to make them a band. He doesn't have to do that. He didn't have to rehearse them every day in the backyard. He didn't have to drive them to the Regal Theater in Chicago. He could have just put that guitar back in the room and gone away. Or he could have said, do what you want to do, but not given them any encouragement, not given them that extra push. So there's a kind of enlightened self-interest. Joe was a frustrated musician. Joe had wanted to be a star. It didn't work out. He was in a band called the Falcons. No one remembers it. And these kids suddenly have all this talent. Joe then, at the same time, Joe's a disciplinarian. And I think one of the things about that kind of black man, who's basically my uncle, my father, and from that era, you know, who knew the Depression, is that there's a kind of sense of control in their home. It's one of the only places in the world where they have control. And it's not enough to have control. They have to dominate that space. And I've seen that scenario in my family, that particular generation, from my uncles who worked at the shipyard in Virginia. So when people condemn Joe or you can't take Joe out of context of a black man, a working class black man, working at a job with a house full of kids who daily, if not emasculated, at least disrespected on some level by the world around him. So I'm not saying that what he did, whatever Michael accused him of, because Michael says he locked him in the closet, Michael said he treated him badly and beat him, but anyone who grew up in a black household of that generation knows getting beat was not unusual. Okay? We all know about the strap. We all know about getting the switch out the backyard, pick your switch. So there's a certain level of psychological control that was part of how black people were raised in that generation. Now, that may have gone away. Maybe we just say time out, go in the closet, that corner now. But that's not how our parents did it. And Joe was one of those people, okay? So I just think when I see Joe painted, and I mean, I dealt with Joe quite a bit. You know, not the most pleasant man I ever met. Brother had a, he used to have a, in his office he'd have a lion, because if you see Joe, he looks kind of like a lion, right? Joe literally had a bronze lion on his desk. So he knew what it was. And he used that. That was part of the mystique of what he was creating. So I think we need to, when we talk about Michael, and we're going to talk a lot about Michael this weekend, Joe and Joe's relationship to his sons and Joe's relationship to the world around him cannot be, you can't have this discussion without really dealing with the complexity of Joe Jackson. A lot of Michael's imagery comes from his mother, who's a Jehovah's Witness. And he was the only of Michael's family. Joe was the only one of the boys who showed any interest in being a witness. He went to Kingdom Hall. He read the books. And if you watch, even if you watch a Can You Feel It video, there's imagery in it you could suggest might be from the Jehovah's Witness point of view. This fellow, you know, the chosen come back to earth and they redeem the dead. There's a lot of, a lot of all of the stuff that you think about comes out of that house, that little room in Gary, Indiana in the 1950s and 60s. So it was strange because the book comes out in, I think, January 04. And that's the same period on which several things happen. The most significant probably is the fire. The fire happens in L.A. at the Pepsi commercial, the Shrine Auditorium, which at the time was traumatic. It also, in a strange way, made him a bigger star, right? And we know now that, in fact, the burns from that fire were part of what led him to use painkillers, and that may have had affected, you know, his use of plastic surgery. A lot of things happened out of that fire that only really, I would say, in the last few years, had become clearer the long-term ramifications of that. So that's a signature event, that fire and the ramifications. And then the other irony is that on that same stage at the Shrine Auditorium, within about a month, is when he gets the 18 million Grammys that he won for Thriller. So in that same space, there's that moment of incredible triumph in that same space and incredible tragedy that lays the groundwork for a lot of what happened later. So the book comes out, and it's part of an incredible thing. And I think the thing that happened around 84 to 85 with Michael Jackson, I don't know that anyone can be as big as he was then, no. Ever again. I mean, there's been people who were big. I mean, I don't know. Let's pull a name. I can't even think of. I mean, Oprah's big this way. Like, she's had this long arc, right? But in terms of, like, dominating almost every aspect of the pop conversation, going to the White House because Reagan wants to get his photo op. You know, all of these moments. And the other thing that's said about Michael during this period is that every eccentricity that people look back now, wow, that's weird, they didn't look at it that way then. It was all Michael's eccentric. That's cute. Michael's eccentric. I mean, you know, Bubbles the monkey. We love Bubbles the monkey. The elephant man's bones. I mean, we all took that as another sign of his creativity and let it go. Only later does those things become, do they get turned on him to become condemnations. So everything is context. That period was of almost unprecedentedly positive media coverage as I've ever seen. And when it turned and probably has never really reversed. Okay, so that was an interesting time to be around. I went to the show in Kansas City, the first show of the Victory. I saw three shows on the Victory Tour. And actually, I got to give a shout out. My editor at the Village Voice at the time, Robert Christgau, is here. And one of my favorite pieces I've ever written of journalism is a piece called Chocolate Chips and Ice Capades, which is basically about going to three of those shows and watching the crowd. Because when I went to that show in Kansas City, and, you know, I'd seen Michael at Madison Square Garden, you know, it was a little boy. to go to Kansas City, 65,000 people, and it's like the Ice Capades. It's like he's so all-American. It's unbelievable. I mean, and again, that's that kind of success. Beyonce's big. Beyonce ain't that. You know, Jay-Z's big. He ain't that. It's a whole nother level this guy had reached that, you know, unprecedented and unreachable again, at least for a recording artist, I believe. So we go through all of that, and what was really wild about being in the middle of that media ride was how overwhelming it was, and then how, as a person who's benefiting definitely from Michael's success, I got really scared. Because what I felt would happen, and this is something that a choice some of the musicians had to make it work with them, either you were going to be in it for the haul and be bout it, and be with Michael do or die, you were going to pull out. And for me, I didn't want to become Michael Jackson expert, and that would be my life and career. And there are guys, authors that we know, that's what they're known for. They're Michael Jackson experts. That wasn't what I wanted to be. And so there was a time that I actually stopped writing about Michael. I would consciously not write about and not talk about him because I felt like I'd gotten so associated. I didn't want to get swept up in the power and the massiveness of this man's shadow because it was that all-consuming. It would burn like it was, you know. The only analogy, my favorite analogy about Michael now I've been using since he died is Citizen Kane. And those of you who know the film, you know, Neverland is Xanadu. You know, Kane had a media empire that stretched across the entire globe. Michael had a musical success that spanned the entire globe. And then, you know, Kane dies alone, basically, in this mansion full of all his artifacts. The difference is, of course, that Michael had lost his place. He didn't die in his mansion. He died in a rented place somewhere in Los Angeles. We don't know what Rosebud is. Tori's asking what Rosebud is. That's interesting. That's what everyone's looking for, isn't it? What is a Rosebud? I think a Rosebud is going back to those days as a boy in the Chitlin' Circuit. I think that a lot of his... I mean, we can talk a little bit more about this, but just this idea that this man was so productive. I think one last idea that I'm going to read just a little bit from the book. He was so productive from the time he was 6 till I would say 35. He did Thriller in 6 weeks. The album was done in 6 weeks. When he died, from the period of his last formal studio album, which was what year was that? 2001. From 2001 to 2010, this guy recorded tons and tons of songs. There's L.A. and Babyface songs out there. I've heard a few couple of them. There's other R. Kelly records. There's more Teddy Riley. There's oodles and oodles of tracks. There's a guy named John Barnes who's... his only real songwriting credit that you might see was Michael. He co-wrote Captain EO. But he was part of a little team of people who sometimes lived with Michael and Encino, who was on 24-hour call at one point for demos. So there's tons of demo tracks. There's really a wealth of material. But here's the thing. He kept working, but he wasn't either because of commercial pressures, because the record company didn't feel like they could promote him properly, or his own insecurities about quality. Here's a guy who was so productive for most of his life, who basically becomes a non-performer, non-record artist. The thing that had animated his life from the time he could barely walk, he stops doing, and then he comes back at the end. He tries to come back in his last period. And it's a strange thing, because knowing, this may sound weird, this is the Virgo thing again, but anybody knows Virgos, though, that we're some working people. We don't stop working. That's poor Beyonce's problem. She can't stop work. I mean, Virgos just keep going. So for him to not have music out in the marketplace must have been devastating to his soul. And I think, I mean, I look at all the stuff that happened to him. A lot of that has to do with, to me, inactivity. This is a guy who was never idle for most of his adult life. And suddenly is, you know, he comes in his home country. He is persona non grata. The record company doesn't want to put the money in. Tour promoters are skeptical. You know, he tours every now and then. He plays overseas somewhere. Even the show in London is an interesting manifestation. About a year before he announced he was going to come back at Wembley, I was in London. I was walking down Shaftesbury Avenue in central London, and there's this giant Thriller musical that had already been playing around the UK for a couple of years. Now, it is terrible. It's terrible. I mean, it's like 18, 19 British singers singing various Michael parts. Whoever the American Idol singers of the UK, they're on the show too. They're singing Ben, right? It's really bad. The bar mitzvah band is in the pit. It's terrible. But I went in and bought a ticket because, like, you know, I went in to see the thing, and the crowd in the theater was, there were Middle Eastern people, there were people from China, there were Croatians in there. The accents in the theater, as they were sitting on the seats, was a global experience. That play, even before Michael announced it, was already selling out and a hard ticket to get. So what's also interesting in terms of Michael is that the international audience never really abandoned him the way we did. Okay, never really abandoned the way we did. And part of that, I think, has to do with race. One of the things with Michael is interesting, and someone spoke about their your niece's nephew. So I had a conversation I talk about in the book with Fatima Robinson, she's a fantastic choreographer. She did Remember the Time and just a great woman. And her son was 9 years old when we spoke, and was obsessed with Michael Jackson. He wanted to get a Jerry curl even. Okay. And I was like, wow, that's pretty serious. And she said, well, you know, my son likes both the white and the black Michael Jackson. Because as a 9-year-old boy, his context is what he sees here. There's none of this historical context there. So he's just taking it as it comes. Michael transforms. Michael's almost for a kid who grew up on video games, what's the difference between him changing from brown to white? That's not no big deal. So I'm just saying, when you look at kids, I don't know, never met a kid who didn't love Michael Jackson. It's unbelievable. There's something about that innocence that pops through the screen and goes right to children. Children love this guy. But this idea that Michael is a fluid, for us in America, his racial identity is as a black man. That's who he's always going to be, right? To someone in India or Croatia or in China or in Seoul or in South America, he's a figure. He's removed from their experience. He's not necessarily judged by the same black and white ways that we do here. And I think that that's an interesting phenomenon, is that this fluidity that younger people take for granted. You know, we as a black American, how can I view him as other than a black man? But this is just something to be discussed and think about, that we look at this global impact he had. Part of it is the fact that he is racial. To a lot of people, he's racially fluid. When I did that Michael Jackson book in 1984, it was translated into about 4 or 5 different languages, one of which was Japanese. And when I saw the Japanese edition, it was completely different than everyone else's edition. It was an oversized book with multiple pictures, and most of the images of Michael that were depicted in the book from the Japanese were of a lighter, Asianic-looking Michael. So everyone adopted their Michael Jackson, depending on where they were in the world and how they consumed him. If you travel around the world, even to this day, if you go to India, I went to India 2 years ago. I went to Barcelona. I went to Madrid. Michael's image is one of the few images of someone we would call African-American that you're going to see in a record store anywhere in the globe. But the Michael that they have is this middle Michael. It's like this middle Michael between not the little black one, but not the all white one. This middle place. Okay. that's the Michael that seems to be accessible to people and is different because maybe he looks more, I don't know why. I mean, we can make a, but I'm just saying when you travel and see Michael's image, what they embrace, it's that one. So it's an interesting journey, and I think one of the things we have to do and be interesting to discuss is what does Michael seem like? We have a cultural context for him, but the cultural context in which he's consumed, a lot of the places is very different than ours. And maybe, rightly or wrongly, that may be part of his international appeal. So I just want to read a couple of sections from the book. As I wait on the ladies in my life, I sit in my bed in the public housing bedroom I share with my sister, flipping through copies of Ride On magazine, which in the years before BET's 106 and Park is where young black kids kept up with their teen idols. I read about a pickup basketball game, the Jackson family's Encino home. I wonder if I could take Jermaine off the dribble. My sister and mother are now ready. We grab our coats and a knock on our neighbor's door. Betty and her son exit the apartment, and we all ride down the elevator from the 6th floor. who live in the Samuel J. Tilden Housing Projects in Brownsville, Brooklyn, an area that is one of the worst ghettos in America. We walked down Livonia Avenue with the 16-story Tilden buildings to our right and the elevated RIT subway tracks looming to our left. Before we go upstairs to the elevated train, my mother buys Wrigley Spearmint Gum at the local candy store on Rockaway Avenue, as we all keep our eye out for the junkies who hang menacingly on the corner. The long ride takes my family and friends from Brownsville near the end of the RIT line, across Brooklyn through Crown Heights, Bed-Stuy, Park Slope, downtown Brooklyn, and then into Manhattan, running under Wall Street, through Greenwich Village, up to the Garment District, and finally to West 34th Street. On that long ride, we talk about previous trips to Manhattan. My mother, who's studying to become a teacher, has taken us to many events in the city, from Mary Poppins to Ossie Davis's Pearly Victorious on Broadway. But this family outing is one of the most memorable of our lives. We went up to 34th and 7th Avenue, joining the throngs of black and white families filling into the Madison Square Garden, the world's most famous arena, which is only 4 years old at that time, and has been the site of the first Ali Frazier fight and the Knicks NBA championship. I've listened to so many games on the radio being played in this building, and yet it's only my second time inside. We sit up high in the green seats. Those who remember the old guard remember they used to have the blues with the top green. Green was, you know, damn near nosebleed. Blue was total nosebleed. We were too excited to be upset about our nosebleed seats. My mother's happy because Chuck Jackson, a deep-voiced soul singer and a longtime favorite, is one of the opening acts, obviously placed on the bill as an acknowledgement to all the parents in the house. When the Jackson 5 takes the stage, the piercing screams of teenage girls fill the garden. Michael moves swiftly across the stage, a little dynamo who reminds me of Mighty Mouse, the hyperactive Saturday morning cartoon character I adore. The Jackson boys in their multicolored outfits glide across the garden stage, and their afros, perfect ovals of jet black hair, look like halos. Though the crowd is very integrated, there's a palpable sense of pride emanating from the many black families in attendance. The Jackson brothers, as well as their parents, Joe and Catherine, represent our potential and our dreams. If they could emerge from the working class slums of Gary, Indiana, so my family might escape public housing in Brooklyn. The Jacksons represent a growing sense of possibility for my family. One day I could even write a book about Michael Jackson. In a world where a black family led by an astoundingly talented little boy could sell an arena in New York City, anything could happen. So that's the first section of the book. I just want to read one more section, and this is about This Is It. The film that came out on October 28, 2009. I, like thousands of others around the globe, brought a ticket to see This Is It, the 111-minute documentary carved out of an estimated 110 hours of rehearsal footage for Jackson's personal archives. Despite the international hype and folks dressed up at midnight shows around the globe, I walked up to the box office at Cineplex Theater on 3rd Avenue and East 11th Street to my friend Ticket Salam. I purchased two tickets for a mostly empty 1:45 p.m. show. Inside the basement theater, we watched the film with about 10 other Jackson fans. Sony released the film in some 8,000 theaters worldwide, an additional 3,000 in the U.S. That's a nice number of domestic theaters for a documentary about an unfinished concert. But international enthusiasm appeared much higher for the film, even in China, not a place usually considered a safe haven for valuable U.S. copyrights. Although our theater isn't crowded, the online chatter about This Is It was standing room only. Reviewers across the globe weighed in and sometimes reluctantly found merit in the documentary. This Is It, said one, isn't Michael Jackson at his greatest. It's him preparing to be his greatest, but watching his preparations is gift enough, wrote Tom Long in Detroit. Quote, there's no sign of sickness here, no sense of an artist past his prime, and so you see a performer at his peak, wrote a surprised Newark Star Leisure reporter. CNN's reviewer didn't want to recommend the film, but finally admitted, yes, you probably want to see this. On the Rotten Tomatoes ratings of films from the outstanding top film critics, the film received an outstanding 86% rating. On Twitter and Facebook, fans were mostly ecstatic. But on the online space, there's a large, well-organized minority who saw This Is It as a collage of lies. On June 25th, 2009, Michael Jackson died. He was 50 years old and a father of three young children. Were you shocked? You should have been, wrote the folks at thisisnotit.com. In fact, the true state of Michael Jackson's failing health was being hidden from you by those who were seeking profits from the screening of This Is It. Furthermore, the site stated, quote, a few scenes were selected in which Michael Jackson smiled and showed that despite of being in a dire state, he was still the greatest star in the world. Having been in scores of edit rooms over the last 10 years, I know this is not it. It's likely more right than wrong. Any edit of 110 hours of footage into 2 hours of film could yield literally a dozen different versions. Moreover, any version of the documentary financed by the promoters of the London shows was unlikely to include any images that suggested Michael was near death during rehearsals. The popular narrative was that the preparation for these shows killed the superstar. As I sat in my seat, I was sure no visual evidence of that theory would be present. My friend Tigis, who's an actress and writer of Ethiopian German descent, was a woman who was introduced to Michael's work as a child living overseas, tears up at the first sight of Michael on screen. In fact, for most of the movie's running time, she was either crying or red-eyed, saddened about seeing the singer all over again. At 50, Michael is tall and imposing man, with huge hands and long arms. He's clearly underweight, and even though the film doesn't make him look sickly, he definitely looks frail. There are no close-ups of Michael in the film. We never get closer than a shot from the waist up, and mostly see him at a middle distance, an adoring removed from our gaze. Far enough away for us to see his grace, but never close enough to really truly be intimate with him. His face, the skin, the nose, the eyes, almost feel hidden in plain sight. The visual strategy makes clear there's something quite extraordinary. Michael is actually a better, more complex dancer than earlier in his life. Compared to the cocky, committed team of dancers around him, Michael isn't as athletic or explosive. But the precision of his movement, how he glides from stage left to right, his sharp head and body turns are more glorious than ever. He appears to hear several kinds of rhythm, the beat of Jonathan Moffitt's trap drums, the bass lines played by Alex L, and then internal eight counts, where he interjects combinations of hand gestures, shoulder shakes, and dance steps. Watching Michael move recalls listening to a skilled drum circle, where a master drummer creates the central rhythm, and other percussionists circle his beat, sometimes joining the central pattern, and other times floating off to construct a new rhythm that the other drummers may follow. Jackson dances like that master drummer. It is his feel for time, both for rhythm and the pauses between beats, that guides him through the rehearsal. Phrases such as "let it breathe" and "I'll feel it" pepper his instructions to his collaborators. In conversations with the director Kenny Ortega and musical director Michael Bearden, Jackson is very precise about what emotion a song, a piano part, or a lighting cue can create when properly placed, all of which are elements of timing. Joy, pain, and pathos are all conjured in what he'd call magic, what I'd simply call a unique sense of time and space. Jackson is careful throughout the rehearsal footage with his vocal cords. Sometimes he sings all the words to a song. Often he leaves out parts or verses, especially on up-tempo numbers when he's focused more on dance moves or staging. This is not unusual for a performer in rehearsal, but when you see the rigor of the planned show, and Jackson is not having done a full-on series of concerts in half a decade, you have to wonder how he'd gotten through 50 shows. My plan had been to attend one of the first 10 to 15 shows in London, figuring he'd still be in top shape and in peak voice in the early shows. Two moments in the film, one troubling and the other sublime, lingered with me well after I left the theater. During the Jackson 5 medley, Michael looks uncomfortable. At one point, he stops singing and complains about the sound mix in his earphones, saying his ears feel like being punched by the sound. The amateur Freud in me suspects that the real source of his discomfort is singing those long-ago songs associated with his 10-year-old self, that round-faced, bushy-haired dynamo from Gary, Indiana. But maybe that's me projecting my own discomfort onto the singer. The truth is, watching him perform those songs of his, Our Youth, put me right back out of the movie, send me back to Madison Square Garden, watching him gyrate all brown and 1970s fly when I was a little boy. Until he does I'll Be There, I accepted the tall, pale figure as Michael Jackson. When he sings Just Look Over Your Shoulder, Honey, I heard that child's voice on the Motown records, and I felt alienated from this man whose Jackson 5 songs are so connected to a particular Black is Beautiful period. That picture of the pubescent Michael Jackson that accompanies the songs only heightened my disconnect from the film. And yet this Michael Jackson, or at least his latest incarnation of the man, is a person fully invested with the DNA and talent of that long-lost little brown boy. His Billie Jean at Motown 25 in 1984 was a defining moment of Jackson's career. Several generations have moonwalked in his wake. However, his Billie Jean performance in This Is It I think, is a bit of perfection that confirms his legacy. Within the Billie Jean dance, which is familiar to any in Jackson's catalog, Jackson reinvents himself on the staple stage. Using his arms and fingers and holding his torso at precise angles that dramatize every movement, Jackson remakes Billie Jean as a dance for an older, wiser man. His dancers go crazy, though they go crazy many times during the film. But here, their cheers are indeed warranted. And at the end of this magnificent dance, Jackson says, "Well, we got a good feel for it." No one watching this dance will shrug it off so casually, just as no one watching will understand how dope that performance was more than the dancer himself. And at the time Jackson did this dance, it was simply some sweet moves at a rehearsal and nothing more. But now and forever, it is Michael Jackson's last act of magic. So, that's it.
Loving you already, brother. You're doing your thing right now. Just a couple of thoughts, because I want to get to talking with Nelson and hearing some of your questions and getting you guys involved in the conversation. But you know that you're in a safe Michael Jackson space when Joe Jackson can be given love and understanding, and nobody's like, "Oh no, what are you talking about?" So that's love. I'm going to give you guys just a couple of thoughts that I had about Michael and read a little bit that I wrote and then get to talking with Nelson. Watching Thriller, it occurred to me that that was an amazing example of when life gives you lemons, make lemonade, surrounded by zombies, become one. Join them, dance with them, be the best zombie out of the whole group. He's also giving you his own dance language. When he passed, you had dancers and choreographers talking about this man created something amazing. He's not just dancing. He has his own language that develops through time, but then there's still the same signifiers and tropes that keep going on. And this was not dated. It does not look like, you know, the clothes are of the period, but it's not like, you know, if you put that out now, it's like, oh, well, that's some old, you know, that's the way we used to do things. It's a very now video. I think everybody in this room knows that Michael Jackson was the talent of a century, you know, singing, dancing, producing, writing, on and on and on. But there's so much else also that goes into the miracle of creating this one cultural phenomenon. He goes to the best possible school ever, Motown, and also sitting in the wings watching Jackie Wilson, going through the Chitlin circuit, being close to James Brown, Berry Gordy also telling him what to do business-wise, Suzanne DePass helping him, and also Motown is the best brand possible, right? So he's already stamped with greatness. He has a long career before, and he also comes from a family, which is important, right? Which gives you the sense of wholesomeness. You can trust him. Not only is he up on stage, but his mother and father are in the wings. They're part of the story. His brothers are part of the story. As he gets older, his sister starts to become part of the story as an actress, and then later as a singer herself. And I think I'm dating myself there. I mean, I remember her from Good Times. Who remembers her from Different Strokes? She was the one, like, at Different Strokes, she was the one. Oh, my God. So he had a long career before Thriller comes out. So he has the artist development, he has the name brand, the household name brand. He also has the experience of how to deal with his instrument that a much older person would have, but he's 24, 25 making this record, household name, and he also has the power to deal with the record company, to get the massive budget, to get them to go to MTV and say, "Hey, you better play this black guy and break your segregation policy," because MTV was not playing black artists before Michael Jackson came. And also the power to get Quincy Jones. The label did not want Quincy Jones to produce the record. He was too jazzy. And Michael said, "No, this is the guy I want." There is no Thriller as we know it without Quincy Jones. But there's also a couple of other things that are happening at that same early 80s period. You have the rise of the compact disc. So So people were excited to have this new format to buy music through. You also had the rise of the yuppie and the buppie. So you had an explosion of disposable income in America. You also had the explosion of MTV. So this suddenly, this is the greatest record radio station that everybody's watching, everybody's paying attention to. I remember going to, because a couple members moments I remember. I remember going to my friend's house when they played, when Thriller just came out, and they played, because we didn't have cable, because my mom did not believe in us having cable at that point, but we got it later. But they played Thriller at the top of every hour, so we sat there and waited until the top of the hour for them to play Thriller. I also remember watching his cartoon show, eating my cereal as a little boy. You know, so we're kind of growing at the same time. He's a little older than me. So, you know, he's a little boy, like the superstar little boy, and I'm a little boy right beneath him. When I get to be a young adult and start going to dances, they're playing Off the Wall, right? And he's talking about being a young adult and breaking through, and I'm dealing with those things personally. As I said, I remember the first time I saw the Thriller video, I remember watching the Motown 25 explosion with my mom and my sister. I remember sitting there, and when he came out with his brothers, my mom was like, yeah, because that's her Motown nostalgia. But then when they left, me and my sister were like, yeah. And then when he went up on his toes, all three of us were like, oh my God. Like, we knew at that moment something extraordinary had happened. It was electric. And I remember, I have not ever told this story, but I will share it because this is a safe space and we are friends. The first concert I ever went to was Sade. The second concert I ever went to was the Bad Show in Paris. I was in Paris for the summer doing, and I went to stay at their house, and then their boy my age came to stay at my house later. We went to the Bad Show, and it wasn't just because of the extraordinary electricity of Michael Jackson. It was a lot of things. It was hot. We were cramped in like this in that open air thing, and I was young, and it was exciting. It was my second concert, and I passed out. I was one of the many people who was like passed over to the front row. And the French security like took you over to the side and they gave you water and they're saying, are you okay, in French? And I don't really understand what they're saying. And I'm like, oh, fine, fine, fine. Nah, it's not the music. It's hot out here. But this is a safe space. So that's going to stay here, right? We're not going to Twitter about that, right? Embarrass me on Twitter again. All right, let me read something that I wrote about Michael, and then we'll get to talking to Nelson and to you guys. This is something I wrote that was part of Rolling Stone's book about Michael Jackson that was published shortly after he passed. It's called Black Superhero. When Michael Jackson was a boy, you didn't have to say black is beautiful. You just had to look at him and you knew. In 1969, as black people were getting comfortable with the idea that African features are gorgeous, he arrived as the perfect punctuation of the idea. He was cherubic with his rich brown skin, a broad nose, and a big halo of curls atop his head at a time when the afro was a powerful sense of black pride. Skip Gates said, people responded viscerally to Michael Jackson's beauty. 1969 was a year after the assassination of Dr. King, a time when the black power and civil rights movement seemed to be disintegrating, but Michael showed up, a soul music prodigy, irrepressibly optimistic and bursting with youthful enthusiasm. Music industry veteran Gary Harris said, here was a child who clearly understood the R&B idiom. He was a sort of test tube creation from a mad soul doctor's lab. If Diana Ross and Stevie Wonder had a child, it would have been Michael Jackson. He quickly became the number one black child star of his era and of all time. The first four Jackson 5 singles each topped Billboard's Hot 100, an unbelievable start. Black people fell in love so hard, he became more than an artist, he became a member of the family. You didn't want anything to happen to him so much that you felt protective the way you did about a younger brother. Q-Tip said, he was ours. He meant everything to black culture. It wasn't just about Michael. A few years after the Johnson administration declared the Black family broken with the Moynihan Report, the Jackson family was large, intact, vibrant, successful, and seemingly happy, giving America an idealized image of domestic bliss. Jay-Z told me he grew up pretending to be Michael, singing alongside his two older sisters and his brother. Al Sharpton said, here you had Michael and his four brothers, all talented, all cute, and the strong father, and the mother who's matriarchal, and Janet, and it was like, wow, all this talent in this family showing we could do something, we were proud of that. Michael had a second family. Motown was a deeply trusted brand in millions of Black households. If Berry Gordy said it was good enough to release, you could bet it was great. The Jackson Five were the last great act to come out of the Detroit label, further proof of Malcolm Gladwell's theory in Outliers that life timing is critical to success, that the historical forces swirling around the moment when you emerge can make all the difference. Questlove said, the Jacksons were the first family in line to truly benefit from the post-civil rights era with America's new open-arms policy toward Black entertainment. He continues, 1969 was the year the social floodgates opened, and an 11-year-old led the charge in the post-Malcolm Martin Motown America. Historians always forget the third most important M to help Black America get access to the promised land is Motown. Thriller came out at the end of 1982 as the affirmative action generation was beginning to make its move. Jesse Jackson would make a bid for the presidency. Eddie Murphy would launch his assault on the top layers of Hollywood. Oprah would start her legendary talk show. And Bill Cosby would create the best-rated sitcom of the decade. But even before all that started, the vibe of Black ascensionism was in the air, and Michael saw no reason why race should hold him back from the most elite level of his profession. He decided to ride his excellence to the zenith. Current Motown president Sylvia Rhone said, throughout his career, his success dramatically affected my view of what was possible and open for African Americans. Many Blacks now compare Michael with Barack Obama, perhaps the highest possible compliment in Black America. Not only are they both integrationists and racial harmonists, but they were both determined to reach the top while refusing to let race hold them back. Puffy said, there's so many components of why Barack Obama is president, and Michael Jackson is one of them. He started a change in the perception of the African-American male on a worldwide level. His strength, always putting himself in a power position, being seen as a hero. Sharpton echoed the point. Way before Tiger Woods or Barack Obama, and this was written way before the Tiger Woods thing changed. I think he would say something different now. Michael made Black people go pop culture global. You had people in France, South America, and Iowa comfortable with their kids imitating a Black kid from Gary, Indiana. And when some of those people in Iowa grew up, they were comfortable voting for Barack Obama because they got comfortable imitating a Black kid named Michael Jackson when they were young. Obama is a phenomenon, but he's the result of a process that Michael helped America graduate to.
You know, when you started talking, I began thinking about we talk about Mike as a figure in Black culture, but his success with Thriller actually affected the entire idea of success in the recording industry. It was after Thriller that you have Bruce Springsteen's Born in USA. It's after, you know, Purple Rain. Warner Brothers definitely sees more potential for Prince and Purple Rain after Thriller than they did before. Obviously, Madonna's career. Lionel Richie, direct byproduct, his success on Michael. I mean, if you look at Can't Slow Down album, it's very much modeled after Thriller. So, I mean, he had a. So, the idea of what success was for recording artists was changed in that entire era. All this idea of the massive pop star who can go on and make these massive videos and go on these amazing tours and sell over 10 million records regularly. That was something that was unheard of really prior to Thriller. So he just changed. He changed the entire nature of what success was.
And it's extraordinary that he is the greatest video maker of all time. I mean, he comes along at the beginning of the video era and nobody could top this over. Nobody's even really close.
Well, I don't know.
Who's close?
Madonna.
I don't think Madonna has a bank of movie-like videos that you could put up
I would say it this way. The arc of Madonna as a video artist alone, not as a recording artist.
Just as a video artist.
It's pretty impressive. I mean, she's been making interesting videos longer than Michael did because Michael got out the game. I mean, to this point, after Michael stopped being...
I mean, I'm not saying Madonna is bad. She's good. I respect her as an artist.
I'm just saying she's the only person I would have in that conversation because of her body of work and the innovative nature of how she's played with sexuality, you know, throughout her career. So that you know, she's the only one I would even have that conversation about. Other than that, it's really...
I mean, he's made several movies out of it, you know, and I just think that that's really extraordinary, the way that he's involved, not just Landis, but, you know... Scorsese, right. You know, and John Singleton, and
Spike
Lee, constantly bringing in new technologies, the morphing, which we had not really seen before.
In black and white.
You know, I mean, other things. Just really an extraordinary sense of narrative, even in the bad video, you know, and so many other things. It's just an extraordinary part of his whole career.
I think if we talk about things that are tragic or about Michael's career, the fact is that he never made his own Purple Rain. That he's a guy who really reinvented the idea of the video as musical. And it's something I've never quite got my finger on. He knew Spielberg through Quincy.
Moonwalker. It's somewhat of
that. Yeah, but I'm just saying.
It's running away from who he is, trying to escape.
But that wasn't he should have, but never did marshal his celebrity to make the big feature film spectacular that he should have. And I'm not quite sure why that was. Did he want too much control, which may have been part of it? Because if you're going to work with Spielberg or Coppola or George Lucas, it's going to be, they're going to run the show as much as you will. And so... I don't know. I don't think he's too shy to make a movie. He should have made. I think that's the only thing I'm missing out of the whole package, is there should have been this big screen 3D Michael Jackson movie. And I think there was a time when it should have happened, and that was really in this period after Thriller, up in all that whole period. He was the biggest star in the world. How that didn't happen? That's almost like another narrative. How Hollywood messed that up. And also, it was also in the era of there weren't that many still black stars. It was still Eddie Murphy. So it wasn't like there was a ton of competition. It was Eddie, but there was no Will Smith. You know, it was really a moment. When I look at the whole totality of this amazing career. The other thing I wanted to talk about, I talked about Joe a lot, is Michael's relationship to black men, fatherhood, I guess you might say. And that is, his relationship with Quincy is really interesting because if you look at the three records they made, the first one, Off the Wall, is Quincy guiding Michael. Michael writes songs, but Quincy finds Rod Temperton. Between Quincy gets Paul McCartney to give him Girlfriend. They get Stevie, who's a friend of both of theirs, to give them that great song. You know, that album is so strong throughout. But it's really a Quincy Jones manufactured, taking this young guy and molding him. The second album, Michael writes Beat It. Michael writes Billie Jean. Billie Jean. I always think about Rod Temperton had something to do with that. And Thriller. And all these songs that Michael, he wrote a few, there's like three or four key songs. But there's also the sense of balance, because it's so some Quincy stuff that's in there, the songs he found like Human Nature, which is really Quincy's concocted that. That was a song, a bit of a song that he heard one of the guys from Toto had. He found the lyricist, this guy John Bettis, who's like a real pop songwriter. And Quincy put Human Nature together, literally, for Michael. But it's crafted for his voice and his persona. By the time you get to Bad, it's a Michael Jackson, almost every song Michael wrote. He's now the adult. He's now in charge. He's now running things. Except for maybe Man in the Mirror, maybe one other song. Michael, wrote almost everything on that album. So it's interesting that you can see the relationship change. And to me, after he got so big, he felt like he didn't need Quincy. He moved on to Teddy Riley. But that's a different relationship. Teddy's going to come in as, even though Teddy was a hot producer, it's Michael Jackson's show. And there's a really funny story. I interviewed Teddy for Hip Hop Honors, I think, a couple of years ago. And he told this incredible Michael Jackson story, which tells a lot about Michael's process post-Quincy and also how you can run through a lot of money. so he gets Teddy, Teddy flies Teddy out to his house on a helicopter. Teddy lands on Neverland Land, and like 8 security guards fly up and grab him, take him into a room. He hangs out. Mike, he finally meet. They start talking, and he convinces, you know, Teddy, you got to come. Teddy's like, great, I want to work with you, but you got to move to L.A. And not only does he move him to L.A., he builds a bedroom in the studio where they record for Teddy to stay there. Michael has a room, too. But, I mean, like, Teddy, you're here to make this record. Teddy spends, like, I think he said he spent, like, over a year, you know, making this record with Michael, tracks after track after track. At one point, this is a classic story. He's working with something, Michael. Michael says, I got to go out for a minute. Michael goes out. Teddy's messing around. Keep. I think I got it. Mike, can you get Mike for me? We'll have to run him down for you. He gets a call. Mike's on a plane to Australia. He's on a plane to Australia to open up a shopping mall. That, you know, he's got investments. But that's how time was. He can, you know what I mean? He can fly off. And that's the difference between, you know, the young Michael and the older one, is that now he controls everything. And time, instead of making Thriller in 6 weeks, it takes years to make a record. It takes years to accept that a record is right. And literally, talking to L.A. Reid, I ran into L.A. Reid, we had a discussion about Michael. And he's talking about the fact, you know, we did all these songs. He said, you can't believe how many songs L.A. and Babyface, who were then the hottest guys in the game, wrote for him. And I think only one or two made on any of the records. He actually, the Get on the Bus, you know, there's actually L.A. Babyface Get on the Bus song. Right. If you hear the movie, it was never released commercially. Spike doesn't even have a copy of it. So, I mean, this idea that of making these records with Quincy in a very precise, orderly manner became this whole expanse of time.
I talked to Teddy, too, for this story that I wrote, and two things that jumped out, that he talked about Michael wanted to know how he would dance to each song. So he's dancing in the studio in a different way, and that's part of his songwriting process, that he's hearing the record, and he's figuring out how to move to it. And I think that's part of why you get so many of the guttural uhs and ch-ch-cha and all those sort of things, because it's a sort of mouth way of dancing to the song and relating to it rhythmically before you start relating to it linguistically. The other thing that Teddy said that was really interesting is Michael said, remix all the songs. And they sound like remixes. When he said that, I'm like, that makes so much sense. They sound like, you know, you get the original version, right, which is cool, you know. You can play it for your mom, you know. And then the remix comes out, and it's dirty, it's nasty, it's complex, it's way more, it's heavier. And Dangerous to Me is like that. And Dangerous to Me is one of my three favorite, I think it's my third favorite Michael Jackson album, because I think the 5 songs on it that I love are so great and so funky and so complex, and the rhythms and the mouth rhythms that you get. I mean, for me, Thriller is number 2. There's so many great songs, but it's a collection. It's like a greatest hits record. It's not
There's
cohesive.
A couple of bad songs on Thriller.
Oh, sure. I'll let you say that in public. It's not that safe for me. But to me, Off the Wall is the perfect, the best. It's one piece. You know, it fits together. You can put it on and walk away, and that's your party. Right. Just let that rock.
I think an interesting thing that comes out of these discussions is Michael in relation to hip-hop. He was a rhythm person. If you listen to the demos, and you can hear him now in a bunch of the collections, these mouth rhythms, the feet rhythms, he was all about rhythm, intensely. And almost every songwriter that he worked with talks about him coming in the room. As Tori says, the mouth rhythms, the feet rhythms, everything was about this intensification of the beat. When I listen to a song like Jam to me is almost like the beginning of the new way of singing. Because, you know, what happened, Wycliffe takes a lot of credit for this. He says when he remixed, I think, that Beyond, one of those Destiny Child records, he talked about how he broke it up into quarter notes. But if you listen to Jam almost anticipates this idea of, I'm going to change how melody lines are written. I'm going to chop them up almost like a rapper. I mean, Jam, really, it's as close to rapping as probably you can hear a singer do. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that was, not only did he was a master of a certain R&B, but he actually created a new rhythmic approach to vocals that someone like Beyonce, who grew up on Michael, has taken as her stamp. People associate with Beyonce, but You can see it in Michael's work. So I think that's really interesting, is that I always wonder, and I've been trying to find, does anybody have a tape? There's got to be. Michael must have tried to rap at some point. You know, he's got there. I've got to think he's trying. I mean, because anybody who's interested in rhythm as he was, who always was it always beatboxing before there was beatboxing.
I mean, yeah, he definitely had the beatboxing.
You got to think that he took a swing at it.
We got to find
Teddy. Teddy knows.
We talked about this before, that Michael's brand of masculinity did not quite match up with hip-hop's idea of masculinity. And a lot of times hip-hop tended to define itself against Michael
Absolutely.
Jackson.
Absolutely. He comes up a lot in records other side.
LL Cool J. Do you like Michael Jackson? We like Cool J. You know, which is like, you can't like both.
And Run DMC.
I'm a real man.
Yeah.
Yet, like, you know, you could like that girly stuff or you could like a real man. And I don't think they fully got how much of a real man he was, coming from a different generation, a different conception, you know, of the way to be masculine. I mean, like, you look at guys from Europe, right, and they can be that metrosexual. Within an American context,
right,
they seem gay.
Right.
But put them in front of a woman, and she's like, ooh, he's so sexy. And that's kind of what he's dealing with.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I mean, Michael was a big sex symbol, which just got lost in the thing. Was Michael was a huge sex symbol. And I'll tell another story that's actually not in the book because I didn't have the right framework for it. But in talking to L.A. Reid, and in talking to Teddy Riley, guys who spent a lot of time with him, they both told me stories about these women in the studio. Okay, I mean, it's an interesting thing. I was, you know, everyone has their perceptions of what Michael was about. But I tell you what, L.A. Reid is a guy I know very well. I know Teddy Riley very well. These are very straight guys. And they're telling me that Michael had fine-ass women in the studio hanging out with him. I believe him. But also, the other thing they also said about that was that he would not... This is another story out of school. Another friend of mine who, giant Michael Jackson fan, met Michael Jackson and befriended him, I guess, must be around the turn of the century. So he goes to a party with Michael. Michael's asking him, where's Beyonce? Because he's never met Beyonce at this point. Because he wanted to see her. And he made a reference about her derriere. And he goes, I want to see the girl with the... He comes over. He introduced her to Beyonce. Then Michael sees a woman in the crowd and bring her over. Michael chats with her. Michael does not take her phone number. As any well-known star knows, you never take the phone number. Your man takes the phone number. So this guy ends up getting the number for Michael. So it's interesting that there's this whole narrative about Michael as a heterosexual male hanging out with guys I know who are very heterosexual male. But there was it's something interesting. He himself would never consciously, publicly, it was like he had this interesting thing.
He was selling
the innocent.
And he was. I don't think I totally got it until I actually watched Twilight, right? And if you've ever, just this specific part. You know, okay. I had to watch Twilight. I watched it on demand, so it's a second window thing for me. But like, everybody's talking about it. What are they talking about? I didn't like it, but I just wanted to see what are they talking about. But
Robert Patton. He's the Michael Jackson, one of the key moments
in Twilight, if you haven't seen it, is they're together in the bedroom, Pattinson and Kristen Stewart, and she wants him, and he says, no, I'm not going to have sex with you. I'm going to watch you sleep. And he does watch her sleep. And I could hear that if I was in the theater, all the 16 and 17-year-old, 15-year-old girls would be like, oh! Like, that's the most romantic thing possible. More than getting smashed is not having that happen.
Well, I mean,
When I was a teenager, my sister had a picture of Michael on the wall, the yellow vest picture. and thinking back, it was like Michael Jackson was a comfortable sex symbol for a teenage girl because you don't have the sexual anxiety. He's not going to pressure you for sex. He's going to be your boyfriend and hold your hand, as opposed to Prince, who you're frightened he will turn you out. Whole other side of the thing.
That was a beautiful thing about having Prince around. The Prince was the perfect alter. They were
yin and yang.
They were so yin and yang.
But they are both dealing with male and female in one body, but in totally different ways.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, like, and actually, like you look at Michael Jackson and Gary Harrison, well, with Diana Ross and Stevie Wonder, but you could also say the child of James Brown and Audrey Hepburn. And not dealing with Audrey with the racial stuff so much as just the gender stuff. I mean,
but,
like,
but you made a good point about hip-hop. And the truth is, there was a whole... And you don't take Michael and Prince out of context. Freddie Jackson, El DeBarge, there was a very hype, sort of pseudo... feminine thing going on in R&B in the 80s. Remember all, and there's tons of mascara everywhere. O'Brien, remember O'Brien? All of, everyone out of LA had a Jerry Curl and a lot of eyeliner, okay? So, you know, that whole, why hip hop had to exist was precisely because of this. There needed to be a reaction. We went from Otis Redding and Wilson Pickett and David Ruffin, who were men by anybody's estimation, to a kind of David Bowie-esque R&B thing. And, you know, someone had to go, yo, I can't go that way anymore. And so in many ways, hip-hop is a reaction to Michael Jackson.
Sure.
And which is really interesting when you look at this. He was a perfect foil for a kind of uber-masculinity that hip-hop came to represent. Big Daddy Kane, all these guys were about, yes, ambiguity. We're not going to play that game.
Yeah. I mean, hip-hop's men talking to men about things you're going to do with men. This is the first black music ever created, which is not meant to create spaces where men and women will dance together, right? Well, and Michael Jackson is all about that.
Well, New York hip-hop's like that. That's the problem. Southern hip-hop's not about that. Southern is about men and women being very close together.
Okay. All right, this is Mr. Hip-Hop Honors. I'm not going to argue.
I'm just saying, it's one of the interesting things. I mean, this is a whole digression, but if you can follow the patterns of pop culture, masculinity, and femininity through popular culture, one of the things that's going on now with hip-hop and why Southern hip-hop has dominated is that it's very female-friendly. And so when hip-hop took women out of the discussion to a great degree, and it masculinized women. I mean, we can go.
That's a whole other discussion.
We
have about 20 minutes left, maybe a little more. So I want to start to hear from you guys.
There's a mic right there on the side.
Mic over there. I'm sure that some of you can and have already been yelling loud enough to not. I definitely want to get questions from everybody, especially you two have been part of the panel already. I'm pointing at you, sister. You have been part of the panel. So I want the shadow panelists to be getting involved, too. Go ahead.
But I want to say we have until 9 o'clock, so we want to limit the comments to about 1 minute. So just
can we get questions
and not...
Right now, statements, not just...
Yeah, but I mean, let people make statements. Okay. It's Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson and James Brown.
Yes.
Inseparable. It's a continuation of the drum. Bessie Jones of the Georgia Sea Island said, "We are drum folks." Drum folks. Zola Neale Hurston said, "We are drummer folks." Mm-hmm. Drummer. Now, if you take Michael Jackson, James Brown, and Ella Fitzgerald, you make gumbo. Because Ella and Michael, of all the entertainers, had perfect pitch. Both of them were the entire band. You listen to Michael and Ella. Michael is a drum, he's a saxophone, he's every instrument in the band. And people do not, up until this day, appreciate the musicality of Michael Jackson. That's like a hidden aspect. But in the film, This Is It, it came out. Any person of African ancestry pick it up immediate. Other people that are caught in harmony and melody didn't see it because they were shooting the video and they asked him, said, "How do you know when to come in?" And Michael said, "I can feel it."
I just want to add one more comment to what the brother said. The only other person I wish you'd mention is Jackie Wilson. Because if you watch footage of Jackie Wilson perform, Michael took a ton from Jackie Wilson. A ton. In terms of his body, how he held his body on stage, his mic technique, and even Jackie had his little vocal asides, little whoops and swirls that Michael's comes very close to a lot of what Jackie did. And when you watch Jackie with the process hair and the movement, because the difference between Jackie Wilson, unlike James, never went to the floor. He was more, he stayed, his carriage was up, but he was a boxer. He bounced. And Michael took a lot from that. So Jackie, because Jackie Wilson didn't make the great records that James Brown did, and he died tragically. And there's not a ton of footage of Jackie. He's kind of left out of this discussion a lot. But I'm telling you, if you see footage of Jackie Wilson, you Google it right now, listen to Jackie's records. Michael, of all the other people we always mention, Jackie, he's a direct descendant of him as well.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the Michael as a global humanitarian. I don't think we had someone like, you know, like Paul Robeson, Harry Belafonte. I mean, during the 80s Cold War, Michael had entree to parts of the world that America wasn't really welcome. And, you know, kind of paved the way for American culture in that way. And then when you look at the response he received in Eastern Europe, like the former Soviet bloc, it's a really interesting reception that Michael received. So I wonder if you can talk about him as a global figure and also and how the work of USA for Africa played into that.
Mm. Well, number one, I think there's actually going to be a panel tomorrow that's just about that. Am I correct? Do you want to talk about that quickly?
Okay, I thought that was just more like the environmental, but it's broader than that. Okay.
So there'll be a whole, be a whole panel just about that tomorrow. I mean, USA for Africa, I mean, Jesus, it's hard to, I'll just take a piece of it and just say, you know, for whatever reason, the last few years, I've actually traveled more around the world than I ever have in my entire life. And his impact and his presence as a figure is unmatched. I guess Barack Obama now, right? Mm. But, you know, you're talking Muhammad Ali.
Marley.
We're talking Muhammad Ali, Marley, that level, and the Beatles. That's how global he is. He gave a ton of money away all over Africa, other parts of the world. You know, it's one of the things that's a tragedy of the child molestation accusations and charges is that he actually did quite a bit of work with charities with young people. It was children, particularly. And so that's one of the ironies of the whole thing is that he was, some of that intimacy and some of that love, the work that he did was overshadowed by the accusations to a great, great degree, especially again, in the U.S.
I'm glad you said twice there, you said accusations.
Right.
Right, because at least twice when I was on MSNBC in the days after he died, I was put next to lawyers who asserted that these things happened. And I found it really strange that officers of the court would be asserting these things happened when juries repeatedly repudiated and said no, or settlements happened and we're not, this is over. So how are you guys, so they are accusations, and there are many people who have accusations against them. That doesn't mean you're guilty. So he goes through the legal process, he's not found guilty, and yet these lawyers are on TV asserting that this happened. I don't understand.
He was found, but let's be frank, he was found guilty in the Court of American Media. Absolutely.
I mean, he was not at his best in defending himself in the media.
Well, I mean, I'm just going to say this, though. This may be unpopular, but let me just say this. I'm the same age as Michael Jackson. If I was in bed with your 9-year-old boy, it'd be a problem. So I'm just saying this. I don't know what he did. It was proven. But some of his practices were, to say the least, unsound. Okay? And I'll put it this way. One of the things that we talk about, Michael, the complexity of him, even after these things happened, there's a certain kind of arrogance, let's be frank, about being a big star. I think some of the stuff he did, he just did it because he was saying fuck you to the people who accused him, and particularly that district attorney who he had. So I'm just saying that also, I'm just saying context-wise, I don't want to absolve him totally, because I'm not saying he did anything criminal, but as a practicing adult, I'm not comfortable with some of his practices.
But even there, when you're talking to Martin Bashir and you're talking to Ed Bradley,
right.
And I just remember the way that he acquitted himself in those interviews was not as savvy as we know him to be. And I wish that he had been smarter in the way that he had defended and presented his own case so that he could have won the case in the court of public opinion, which I would say he did not.
Let me say something else, and this goes back to even my comment about the women. There was something, he made a decision at some point that the childlike persona, that the voice was going to be his public persona. That's not the mind that made the Beatles deal. That's not the mind that, you know what I mean, that ran a global enterprise. But he, and I, this is the trick. I don't know what, this is the little thing I don't understand myself. Somewhere in there, he said, I need to act innocent. I need, and this is how he decided to present himself to the world. And it allowed him, unfortunately, you can't, that is not a persona that's going to work in a world of 24-hour news media. This is not going to work. And he paid a big price for not asserting a more aggressive attitude in these interviews, quite honestly.
Hi, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Amalia Mallard, and I have a couple of comments. I would argue that Michael's 3D film is Captain EO.
Speak up, please. I'm sorry.
I would argue that Michael's 3D film is Captain EO, you know, Disneyland.
Right.
And so if, you know.
It's Purple Rain.
Right. And then also that Michael did rap on Dangerous, Can't Let Her Get Away. Right before, Oh, and that too, but I'm saying in terms of a moment where he is rapping, it's like before.
Is he
before
actually rapping, or is it like what Marvin Gaye does on Trouble Man, which is more staccato talking, not really rhyming?
Well, I mean, there are different rap aesthetics. You know, there's not just the rhyming, right? So there are different flows.
I think that there's a penguin sort of thing that existed before. Where people were not fully rhyming, they were birds without wings, sort of thing. You know what I mean?
Okay. All right.
Well, let me just say this. In terms of Captain EO, I don't think you can really compare a theme ride piece that's only at Disneyland to a major motion picture that's played in theaters all over the world. So I mean. I have to disagree with you on that.
Well, to me, it makes sense because of how Michael thought of scale, right? It's not enough to be in every theater. I want to be exclusive. You have to pay this much money, to get into a park. And that it's a big ride, and it's George Lucas type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, but if you're really taking the Michael Jackson aesthetic, it would have played in global theater. There would have been a giant screen in Central Park playing it. Right. That's okay. The scale Michael thought of.
One more thing. You both have talked a lot about taking black culture globally, you know, with different figures, Michael Jackson being the topic today. But there's not a whole lot of conversation about what that means other than the cultural legacy, about how, you know, he did the Beatles deal, but in that Beatles catalog was the Little Richard catalog that
Sly Stone.
Right, that he returned to Little Richard, right? So that's a form of reparations.
I don't think that's true. I think that's a popular. I don't think.
Okay.
I don't.
Well, Dick Gregory has said it's true, and I think Dick Gregory is a reliable source, but we'll have to check him. But the other thing to reiterate my point is that in 2002, Michael, when he was at the National Action Network at Al Sharpton's place, right, was talking about how you don't hear a lot about black musicians and their story and their history in terms of being business people. You don't hear a lot about Otis Blackwell, the guy who wrote Elvis songs and other folks, and that they're under. A lot of musicians were either underpaid or glorified employees, and that Thriller basically subsidized a lot of new acts at CBS, then became Sony Records. So there's a lot of talk about black music in terms of a cultural legacy, but not as creative labor and not being recognized as such.
Well, I wrote a book in 1988 called The Death of Rhythm and Blues, which essentially is that. Which is, we talk about Otis Blackwell, it's really an industrial history of R&B. And, you know, when we talk about, I'll take it this way. When we talk about Michael Jackson and the Thriller album, because you took it and talked about the money it generated for Sony. The other thing it did was, it had a profound impact on radio. It had a profound impact Tori talked about the yuppie, buppy phenomenon. One of the things that changed around the time of Thriller was how black music was marketed. I actually write about that, because I was at Billboard at the time. We talked a lot about catalog and about albums. The mom-and-pop stores that had dominated the sale of black music were being transitioned out by the big labels. And that has good and bad. It put a lot of black business people out of work. Conversely, it made it possible, because they began putting the Time records in Sam Goody's in big numbers. They began putting the Prince records, Lionel Richie records, Luther Vandross records. The labels saw more money in black music. They began putting more of their time into the big chain stores for black retailers. They began giving them black records. And the other part of that was the fact that black buying habits began changing. Because black people with money were not living in Harlem, necessarily, the same numbers. They were living in the Oranges. They were living in Montclair. They were more likely, the people who had more disposable income were more likely to buy their records at Sam Goody or Tower or whatever. And so
where when you bought it, each number was counted for. Sounds good.
Yes.
As opposed to mom and pop, where they would call and say, how many were sold? Oh, right. 100 Michael Jacksons were sold.
So Michael's success, actually, I literally write about that whole transition in the business of it in the book. It had a profound effect. Some of it was negative for for some parts of the black community, quite honestly, because once the label saw the amount of revenue generated by Thriller, what's the next Thriller? Is Purple Rain the next Thriller? Is Can't Stand Still the next Thriller? Can we sell more Luther Vandross records? You know, and then Bobby Brown's record is a great example of a record that was marketed as a pop record and using, to some degree, similar formula of Michael, but with Aurora. You know, what Bobby Brown's interesting, because Bobby Brown's interesting because Bobby Brown was the first artist of the new of that hip hop generation who sang, but he sang in the style or the aggressiveness of the old soul guys, without the voice, but the style. But so Bobby's really, because Bobby Brown's record was as big as that
huge,
was it wasn't
huge,
Thriller, but
huge.
It was definitely Off the Wall.
It was huge.
It was
huge.
As big as Off the Wall huge. Was.
That I mean that math of Thriller pays for all the lights, that's normal record company math. I talked to Russell Simmons about it and Lior, and one success funds 10 flops, so that sort of tentpole thing is industry-wide.
Good evening. My name is Matthew Allen. I'm a music journalist from Brooklyn. Just wanted to say how much a fan I am of you guys, and particularly Mr. George. I love all your books.
Thank you.
So many things came to mind, but I had to narrow it down to one thing. I wanted to know if you felt the same way about this opinion that I had that I wrote in a column a few months after Michael died, that Michael Jackson's legacy as far as being a black artist had been ignored for a long time, but I made the argument that his career had the same arc as black figures as Marvin Gaye and Tupac Shakur as far as black figures, because all three of them use their music to express their own contradictions in a way to get their pain and their, you know, their inner anguish out. And I also made the argument that the transition that they made as artists, like Michael's transition from Rock With You to Billie Jean, is no different from the transition from Tupac going from Brenda's Had a Baby to a song like Ambitions as a Writer, or Marvin Gaye going from How Sweet It Is to I Heard It Through the Grapevine. I just wanted to know what your opinion was about that, if you agree that his career had that same kind of arc.
I don't know. I mean, Tupac made a lot of records in a very short amount of time. It's hard for me to make that analogy between him and Michael, because, I mean, the Marvin analogy might, to me, may be more valid, because you have a body of work that goes over decades to compare it to. I don't know, the Tupac thing is...
Marvin did not suffer his public image. We always loved him, and we continued to love him straight through. I think that for Pac and for Michael, there was an absolution in the public image that came from death, that there was a period that you referred to in which most, and you did too, that most Americans were not talking about Michael Jackson, were not loving Michael Jackson, that period toward the end. And because we stopped thinking about the great cultural productions and started focusing on the weird off-stage stuff. And the moment of death, it was like, you know, we all were baptized into, like, oh my God, remember how great he was? Remember these great songs? Remember this great fashion? Remember this great dance? Remember these great videos? You know, and especially 125th Street was a great site of remembrance of the dance, the fashion, the music. And it still is. I mean, he's super present on 125th Street. Like, I mean, you know, I'm from Brooklyn. We don't live Michael Jackson on a day-to-day basis on Flatbush. When I came out of the D train, somebody's playing Dirty Diana. I'm walking down further. I heard another song coming out of a car or a boombox. I'm seeing pictures all along the way. You know, so, I mean, he
is... Well, let me argue with you. Hold a minute. We Brooklyn had the 20,000 people last summer.
I know.
I'm just saying. Don't be giving it to Harlem.
On a day-to-day basis?
I'm just saying. We had 20,000 people in Prospect Park. It was the best party I've ever been to, by the way. It was incredible. Anybody was there? It was an amazing, amazing day. And it'll be happening again this year, folks. So just let us not give it all to Harlem, baby.
Hello, good evening. My name's Esther, Esther Amo. I was born in London, I'm not American, and I was really interested in the global brand of black masculinity that Michael emulated. And there was a different relationship around race and black men in places like London, across Europe. My family's Ghanaian, moving across different African countries, the same thing. And I just wondered if you could both comment on this moving beyond...
Well, why don't you explain...
Are you a singer? You're the singer?
Am I?
Are you a singer?
No.
Oh, okay.
Could you... you have a great voice.
This violence around the consistent visual perceptions of black men around being hypersexualized on the one hand, to be feared on the other. And then in Michael Jackson, there was this kind of radical innocence, but it was in the framework of someone who was brown, who was brown-skinned. Mm. He was not a mystery race guy. You didn't have a question mark about what his lineage was. So for folks in Europe, for me growing up in London, there was a relationship with Michael around race that enabled him to break barriers and move beyond borders. And so as he got older, even down to the charges of child molestation, the innocence that he maintained kept him as a beloved person in a lot of European spaces because it continued that relationship where their perception of black maleness was comfortable. It was gentle, it was soft, and was something not to be feared. Mm. Where he was crucified in the US because the relationship around race and black masculinity here is so profoundly different. As I said, my family's Ghanaian, and I've moved around different countries in Africa, and that's another different relationship again. And I thought that one of the things that he represented that I've never really heard discussed is that global brand of black masculinity and how there's a shape-shifting ness about Michael that reflects different countries' relationship with race and black men that has as yet been unexplored and undiscussed, and really there's not been a depth of exploration to it. I wonder if you might speak to someone.
Well, I mean, that's kind of what I was... Yeah. That's kind of what I was getting at a bit in my earlier comments about how, when you travel to these different countries, how his image is used or accepted. And it is unprecedented. And part of it, I think the innocence thing is a big part of it, because he wasn't threatening. Even when Michael yelled loudest on his records with Dirty Diana, it wasn't like, you know, it didn't feel like he was going to kick anybody's ass, really.
But that's what, you know, what was the video where he was on the car smashing the windows? Yeah, yeah. And that was very shocking because that was a 180 from the classic image, and it was like,
and he pulled back.
Whoa.
You know, here's the thing about Michael, if you look, even at the Thriller video, every time he went there, be it the black and white video, the Thriller video, there's a lot of points where he went a little farther, and he always pulled back. He always apologized.
It's amazing.
Even a Jumi.
I was just going to say that. Amazing, you know, that he could say kike and still have a career.
Right.
I mean, how many people would have been brushed off the face of the entertainment industry for saying that? And in anger.
Yeah.
And he survives that.
You know, one more thing about the global thing. I went to Madrid this summer, and I went to a flamenco club. And I'm watching this guy dance, and he's very intense. And I realized, I don't know if Michael went to a flamenco club when he was traveling, but let me tell you, you see a flamenco dancer, he wears white and black,
Yes.
The hair is slicked back. And the image, you know, Michael's icon, we've like this. Mm. That's exactly a move you will see a male flamingo dancer make. I was sitting there in the crowd like, this is Michael Jackson. This is Michael right here in the flamingo club. In fact, Michael Jackson and Prince both remind me, because the flamingo dancer is a hyper-masculine yet slightly feminine figure, if you ever see him. They wear a lot of makeup. The shit's very stylized. At the same time, he's like this. And the moves are the same moves Michael was making. So it's really, really interesting how much...
What's the move show us again?
That one. So it's really interesting. I just want to say that when we talk about Michael and his involvement and his global, there's a dialogue. He obviously, like any great pop star, was also a sponge. And when I saw that imagery in the club, I realized at some point in his study, he internalized a bit of that and took that and made that part of his thing.
We also haven't talked yet.
Go ahead. Yeah, please.
Hi, my name is Cheryl. I'm a tall lady. Could you pull this up a little if you can? Okay. All right. Mr. George, I don't know, maybe it's me, but I just got a feeling of a thin film of negativity about Michael Jackson from you. Yeah, Mr. George.
A thin feeling of
negativity.
About which thing?
I mean, you know, just slightly, just slightly. Okay. As opposing to the gentleman on the right who seems to be very positive about his... To me.
He's
perceive
written two
this.
Books about Michael. He loves
just
Michael.
Just seem in a negative. It just seem a little negative.
Well, I don't know. Number one.
But wait a minute.
You made a comment. Doesn't mean say. You said a comment about me. Doesn't mean finish.
I glimpsed through your book.
No. Let me finish before you go farther. I'm negative.
All right.
I would say I am not afraid of being critical of Michael. Yes, but I'm not negative. I love Michael Jackson.
I hope you do.
But even if I didn't, would that be?
No, that's your opinion.
One thing that Nelson and I are music critics, music journalists, so it's not always necessarily a emotional, passionate response that he could be critical of Michael or James Brown or whoever and still have a fan love for them over here and then deconstruct the music over here and say, this is great, this is not so great.
But I did say it was my perception, so
okay.
Give me that. That's
and,
my
I, and I have to defend myself when I'm misperceived.
Thank you. I was wondering about your book. Your book, it's a very little book, and I'm wondering how do you cram 40 years of show business in that little book? No
is
pictures.
That a book of-
no pictures are in the book.
This
no
book? Pictures. This is about one album.
The book is basically about the Thriller.
One album?
About Thriller.
And it's...
Okay.
I mean, I read about other things, but it's...
I just got one comment about Michael.
It's primarily
Jackson.
About Thriller.
It's more than 200 pages. This is not a short book.
It's not a biography.
Right. I just want
to
say
something. Let me finish then. You just said... Let me explain the book to you then. It's not a biography of Michael Jackson. It's primarily a book about the making of Thriller with context before and
after. I just want to say something. A lot of the... videos I've been seeing on the internet, one in particular of Michael Jackson. He looks like about 19 or 20. He's got a tux and he's got bubbles. What song is that? He's got bubbles in the background.
From Off the Walls, Don't Stop Till You Get Enough.
Okay, if you listen to that video, and I think you should listen to that video, he talks about this power and this source.
The force has got a lot of power.
Right, the force has a lot of power. And he's always saying that he's being led and channeled. So, if he's being led and channeled by God, you can understand how he can be so magnificent on earth. That's all I'm just saying.
Well, the one thing that I was going to say before she started was one thing that we even talked about is that Michael loved magic and, you know, the prestidigitation. And when you went to see the show, there was all this, he appears here, he disappears, and he pops over here far away, clearly not fast enough to have gone from here to here.
Doug Henning. Who was a master musician to do a lot of his stage show. Also, I mean, even when you look at the Thriller video, I mean, he was interested in magic and in horror pictures and in things
science
that were larger
fiction.
Than life.
And in reveals.
In science fiction.
Science fiction, absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's funny about watching that video, too, because, I mean, that dance that Michael Peters and Michael concocted is perhaps, certainly it's the biggest social dance ever since that time, and maybe one of the greatest social dances of all time. I write in a book about this woman. There's a woman who lived in Canada. She was a young woman who was a choreographer. She became obsessed with the Thriller dance and started this thing called Thrill the World. I don't know if people know about it, but once a year, She organizes this group of people. There are literally thousands of people around the world who, at the same time, all over the world, dance the Thriller dance. The videos are amazing, from Texas, Australia, Scotland. And it's just something really amazing and powerful and affirming about the fact that people want to dress up, have fun, and dance together, you know, because of this music. And it's a very, that of all this music and all these things, it's such a unifying, globally unifying dance. In countries that don't even have Halloween, you know, they don't even have that tradition, they still embrace that dance.
I mean, there's not enough artists who understand that there can be physical hooks. Right, there's sonic hooks, you want to sing along with the song, but then there's physical hooks, so you could stand out there and do a Michael Jackson dance and everybody knows exactly who you're doing. I think Beyonce gets that to a certain extent, and then after that, Janet gets that to a certain extent, and then after that, I don't know who's giving you consistent physical hooks that you can replicate as a regular person. But also within a video, to the magic point of view, there's four times he pulls the chair out from under you. Right, you think you're watching the real thing, and then no, that's a movie. Right, he's watching himself in a movie, so he pulls the chair out from under you, and then you think that he's getting trapped with the zombies, and I'm watching it this time, and I'm like, how could the zombies be walking slowly and surround them, and they don't see it coming? But whatever. But then he pulls the chair out from under you, then he's actually one of the zombies, and then he chases her into the house, and she thinks, here, I'm about to get it, I'm about to die, and he pulls the chair out from under you a third time, I'm a normal person, it's daylight, it's okay, I'll take you home. And then he turns around the fourth time and shows you the eyes, and it's a brilliant sort of end of narrative in that it wraps it up, that he is the other Thriller person, he is the zombie after all, actually, but it leaves you like, what happens after that? Does he nicely escort her home finally, or does he continue pulling the chair out from under her over and over and over? Does he actually turn and eat her? Because you could have the Thriller too, where he, I told you I'm a monster, my eyes are fucked up, there you go.
It's kind of like, what's that one? The Moonwalk is actually kind of the Thriller follow-up. And in terms of the science fiction thing, he had Stephen King work on it.
God, did you ever see that Most Deaf video?
Okay. See?
Where he's, okay. What is that one? Ghost, where he's pulling his face, and it's like he's messing with all of our perceptions of the WJ thing, where it's like, you think that I can take my nose off? You think that this is, look, I can. Yeah. And it's amazing, and you hardly ever saw it. It was like on VH1, like one day marathon, never saw it again.
Right, Stephen King and Michael. Okay, closing comments, or is that... You guys rep.
I love
final.
Michael Jackson.
Right.
I want that to be clear. Unless you didn't get the thin film of negativity from
me. No. So no, but I would like to thank again both Nelson George and Torway, if you can give them a round of applause.
Negativity. Good.
And also, I would like to announce that the conversation will continue tomorrow after the dance panels. And actually, the woman that you heard from, Esther Armar from London, is one of our moderators. So please return for discussions around Michael Jackson's gender and complexion and a number of other things. So please, tomorrow after the dance. And also, Nelson George's book is available in the Schomburg Bookstore, Thriller, The Musical Life of Michael Jackson. Thank you for coming out.